Well, the other day I was reading in John, and I know sometimes you don't really want to know all the inner machinations of how I come up with sermons. Sometimes, honestly, it's me reading something that just a phrase pops into my mind and I kind of chase down the rabbit hole, and that's kind of what happened for tonight's lesson. In that day is the phrasing, but it's one that is not a surprise that you would find it in the Old Testament. It's there a lot. As a matter of fact, as I have here before you, and there's no reason, I mean, if you want access to this list, I'll give it to you, but you see Isaiah has the longest part of all this, but almost everything is in the Old Testament. There are only a few New Testament usages, which here I don't have any of those listed, but in the Old Testament, you're going to find it mostly in Isaiah, Jeremiah, but the point is that God says, this is what's going to happen in that day, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's not always bad and it's not always good, but it's a fulfillment, he says, of what he's promising. He promises good, and he says, in that day, this will happen. He promises bad, and in that day, Deuteronomy, that's actually both things in 31, verse 17, 18. It's all about the threat God has made to the people, and he says, in that day. And you see Isaiah, like I said, mostly there's Jeremiah, a number of the prophets, of course, with Hosea, Joel, Amos, Micah, Zechariah. In the New Testament, you only find it really just a few times, I think altogether, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And of course, you see in Mark, it's stated, Luke, it's the same sort of thing where prophecy is made. Where I came across it was in John, and what I want us to do for a few minutes is spend a little time in John, talking about how Jesus, and he's the one who uses this phrasing. So like in John 14, 19, which the context, one of the great things of John is the only one of the gospel writers that shares with us basically the teaching of Jesus with the apostles the night Jesus is going to be betrayed. So from chapter 13 through 17 is the chunk of what goes on that night. Chapter 13 is where he washes their feet, and even Judas's feet. And then he tells Judas to go do what he's planning on doing, and then he talks to the 12. So he talks to the 12 from chapter 14 really all the way through chapter 17. Chapter 17 is the prayer that he offers to God, and it's the longest prayer that we have access to in the New Testament. So in John 16, we'll look at that here in just a minute, but in 14:19, he says this, "Yet a little while, and the world will see me no more, but you will see me. Because I live, you will also live. In that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. Whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." Now, there are going to be commentaries you might consult about this, and they have a couple few different ideas as to what's going on here. I think Jesus is referencing his resurrection. Now, right now, they don't seem to have a full understanding of what is going to happen with his being arrested and executed and that he will rise. When the whole thing unfolds, they don't seem to go, oh yeah, he told us this was going to happen. But he does many times tell them, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to be executed, crucified. He's very specific about how he'll die. He's going to be crucified and he'll be raised on the third day. And they just seem to gloss right over it. They don't seem to hold on to that at all. It's not like when he dies, they're like, look, in 3 days he'll be back. They don't do that. But when he does come back, it surprises them. And Jesus, as you read, like in Luke 24, opens their minds to understand that all the things he's been trying to tell them are really fulfilled in this moment. So what he's saying here, I don't think they really get, because they do ask some questions. We will get in chapter 16 where they do ask. But here he does again. He's saying, a little while, the world will see me no more. No one will see me, really. But you'll see me. Because, again, 3 days later, he would rise. And that's why he says, because I live, you also will live. In that day, you will know that I'm in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. Like we talked some this morning about God's fulfillment of his promises, We can be assured, like an anchor, you know? That was the whole point in Hebrews chapter 6. We have a sure and steadfast anchor. We have a strong consolation, strong encouragement. Well, he's trying to give that to them now. If you will, turn over to chapter 16. We'll look at verses 16 through 29. It's a lengthier reading from this. And I guess the questions I have here in front of you is, why is Jesus telling them these things? But he wants them to be assured. I think at the end of the day, if I had to say what it is, he wants them to have assurance. They've been with him for 3 years. They've watched all the things that he's done. It's not just the fact that he does it. He has witnesses to him doing it. John actually tells us in chapter 20, verse 30, 31, that there are many other things that Jesus did that John didn't write. But these are written that we may believe. The whole point is the focus of faith. So here we are in 16:16. In the middle of all this, Jesus says, "A little while, and you will see me no longer." It's the same phrasing, not to do anything other than just say, look. In John 14:19, he says, "Yet a little while." So in 16:16 starts the same way. "A little while, and you'll see me no longer." And again, "A little while, and you will see me." So some of his disciples said to each other, "What is he saying?" I know it says it differently. The way it's put in the English translations, I don't like, because it's stilted. It's very not conversational. What is this that he says to us? That sounds awkward. What's he saying? I mean, what does he mean by what he's saying? "A little while, and you'll not see me, and a little while, and you will." I mean, what's he saying? "Because I'm going to the Father?" That's the question. What is he saying? And so they were saying, what does he mean by "a little while"? So they are focusing on that part of what he says. So he says live and in their hearing, "A little while." And they're like, what does that mean? Does this mean a day or two? Does this mean 2 weeks, months, years? What is this? So they were saying, what does he mean? That's in verse 18. We don't know what he's talking about. So Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. And so he said, "Is this what you're asking yourselves, what I meant by saying 'a little while, and you'll not see me,' and again 'a little while, and you will'? Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice." Now here, I know when we see the word "world," we're thinking the entire planet. I don't think that's exactly what's meant. I think this would be like the Jewish leaders, the people who were up to killing him. I mean, it wasn't people living in Africa who were concerned about Jesus, whether he lived or died. Not at this time. There's no other place. This is the place. And the Jews, the leadership, specifically the chief priests, the Pharisees, the scribes, they're after Jesus. They want to kill him. And Pilate even, you know, his observation is because of their envy. That was it. They were envious of Jesus, and so they wanted to kill him. He gets that. I think we can see that. But Jesus doesn't give them all that. He just says, you're asking yourselves, what is this about "a little while"? And this is a little strange to me, simply because this doesn't exactly sound like Jesus teaching, like in the Sermon on the Mount or something like that. There's a lot of repetition in this. I think part of that has to do with initially, this is all not written down for us to read. It was written down for some to read and most to hear. It's an audible sort of thing. So in verse 20, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice." Chief priests and scribes probably were so happy, they got him dead. He's dead. He's not breathing anymore. They have won. And then, you remember, they want him down off the cross, and they let him have that. But then they want to make assurance for themselves by putting a guard in front of the tomb so that they won't steal the body. That was the whole thing. We don't want him stealing the body and then saying, see, he's been raised from the dead. So I like what Jesus says here. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come, you know, to deliver the baby. But when she has delivered the baby, and I know it says it a little differently here, I lost my place. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a person, a human being, has been born into the world. And so also you have sorrow now. So he relates their anguish to a woman giving birth. And he says, you also now have sorrow, but I will see you again. And your hearts will rejoice. and no one will take your joy from you. In that day, you will ask nothing of me. Truly, truly, I say to you, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he'll give it to you. Until now, you've asked nothing in my name. Ask, and you will receive, that your joy may be full. And he's right. At this point, they don't sit around praying day to day, and Jesus says, all right, everybody, let's bow our heads, and they say a prayer and say, in Jesus' name, amen. Right now, they're not doing that at all. And so in verse 25, I've said these things to you in figures of speech. The hour is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figures of speech, but I will tell you plainly about the Father. In that day, you'll ask in my name, and I don't say that I will ask the Father on your behalf. In other words, I won't be the one. We read in Romans 8, the Holy Spirit does that. The Father himself loves you because you've loved me and believe that I have come from God. I came from the Father and I've come into the world, and now I'm leaving the world and going back to the Father. And his disciples said, ah, now you are speaking plainly and not using figures of speech. Now we know that you know all things and do not need anyone to question you. This is why we believe that you've come from God. Now, he goes on talking about their faith and why they now believe, but it's an interesting conversation. If you read it for the first time, it's kind of like, this is, the way it's reported is not, it doesn't flow. I don't know how else to express it. It's just, when I was reading it the other day, it's like, this doesn't flow. I read it out of three or four different translations. None of them did the flow. And I think maybe partly it's how John has it in Greek, that there's no flow. This is maybe him being given the exact thing of how this is given by the Holy Spirit and how it happened. It's not a memory. It's not a thing where he's kind of trying to make a flow. It's just, it's a little awkward how it's expressed. That's, I don't even know how to say what I'm trying to think through all this. If you read chapter 14 and then chapter 16, they sound different. It's just how Jesus is talking sounds different. And I don't know what that means. I'm just throwing that out there. But this whole point about in that day, I think really he's trying to get them as prepared as possible. I mean, he doesn't grab them by, their coat and say, I'm going to be killed, and in 3 days I'll rise, okay? That would be plain. He doesn't do that. He just says, in a little while, the world will rejoice, and you'll be sorrowful. And then he likens it to a woman who's giving birth to a baby, and then after the birth of the baby, all the pain that was there is not there, and she's not even focusing on that anymore. And that's what he tells them that they will feel. They will feel that joy. That's what he says in verse 22. Your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take that joy from you. They're going to experience this. When they do experience it, if you stayed in the Gospel of John and you read from chapter 20 through 21, it's astounding what they go through, the emotional things that, you know, they have a woman who runs in the room and tells them he's not dead, and they don't know what to do with it. They think she's crazy, and then they go home because they don't know what to do. They don't know how to process this. To me, this is one of the fascinating points of proof that this is an actual thing, because Hollywood would write this in a very different way. We would write it, and I say we, people would write it to be much more dramatic. It's not dramatic, it's anticlimactic. The women come in and say, he's risen, we've seen him. And the disciples go home. John tells them, they go home. They all go home. And it's really weird because it's like the resurrection has just happened and they don't know how to process it and they go home. Of course, Peter and John go running out to the tomb to see if it's so, which shows they didn't have faith in the women. They didn't believe what they heard. They ran out and saw it for themselves. And all we're told is, John is a little faster than Peter. He gets there first. Peter just goes into the tomb. John stops at the edge of it. Peter goes right in there, sees what he sees, which is no dead body. He sees, remember, the head cloth that has been folded and everything else there. And they both go home. They don't go out preaching to everybody that he's been raised from the dead. It's a shock. I think genuinely, as you read, it is shock. Because can you imagine someone you love, or maybe not even a person you love, but someone you highly respect, a teacher who dies. 3 days later, he's been raised from the dead. You go into the tomb and you're like, how does your brain deal with all that? How do you just leave and go, well, that's normal. I mean, you know, Ralph, that's what happened with him. I'm saying that. I'm thinking of Ralph Walker, a friend of mine. He would say, Jamie, I'm thinking Ralph. You know, Ralph just, no, that doesn't happen to anybody. And the disciples, genuine people, leave not knowing how to deal with this. But that's the point. Jesus is telling them these things for them to have a little bit of a heads up, an assurance, if you will. Because ultimately, the faith that God wants us to have is not faith in ourselves. It's faith in Jesus. And I think Jesus is trying to bring them into it as fine and as well as he can. And the thing is, he can. He will accomplish everything that he promises. That's what we were reading this morning in Hebrews chapter 6. And understanding that Abraham believed God. And God didn't just promise, but God gave him an oath to confirm the promise. Why? Because Abraham needed that. It's not that God needed to tell him, I promise to do this, and I'm going to give you an oath because I need to do this. He did it for Abraham to have faith. And it's about ultimately us trusting him with our souls. You know, you talk about hope, and I know we've kind of been hitting that for the month, but I want to say this, that people who don't believe in God, and they don't believe in, you know, an afterlife even, they think you live this life, you die, and that's it. There's nothing but maybe annihilation, or maybe not even that. It's just, you just don't have an awareness of anything, and you're gone, you're dead. There's no nothing. I don't know which is scarier, to be dead with nothing or to be dead and facing eternity. I don't know. Both sound pretty scary. I think part of the problem is, and I say part of the problem for humanity is we want to live our lives the way we want to live our lives, no judgment. I mean, really, that's what it boils down to for a lot of folks. And to be able to do our own thing, again, no judgment. And the Bible is telling us there's going to be judgment, you know. That's exactly what it tells us. Not a little bit. It tells us often enough. We're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Every one of us. There's not an exception to that. The exceptions will be the point of whether we were believers in Jesus or not. And there's no real big discussion about deserving anything, because we know what we deserve, but God in his mercy toward us, his love toward us, is not going to allow us to experience that because of Jesus. That's the whole thing. Romans 10:17 reminds us that faith comes by hearing, hearing through the word of Christ. And here's the point, the faith isn't just given for us to have hope now and not hope in the hereafter. I think it would be highly frustrating to have no hope for any sort of future, to think this is it, that this is all of life, this is it. Especially nowadays when on social media everything's focused, I mean, you know, we all know this year is going to be rough because it's already started off rough. We've got politics that is the forefront of a lot of people's minds, right? I don't like it. I hate it, actually. I wish we could get away from all that. Now, we can't. I'm not saying that there's an easy way to just fix that, but there is such a focus. Everything, it doesn't matter what it is reduced to politics. Everything. And I get tired of it. I get really tired of it. I get angry tired of it. You know, it's like, how does baseball come into politics? How does hockey? It does. It's just baseball player says something. Well, the whole world hates that baseball team now because he said something that we don't like, and it was politics. Who cares what the guy thinks about anything? Yeah, I mean, really. But that's the world we live in. And God is trying, I think, on one end, it's Satan who wants us all distracted with this kind of stuff. God who keeps saying there's something far more important and far greater, not just in importance, but in greatness. This thing is nothing compared to this thing, you know? This is much more substantive, talking about eternity. And I think Satan wants us just to not focus on that, to be distracted with anything and everything except the focus that we should have on Jesus. In 1 Peter 2, verse 23, and then chapter 4 and verse 19, we read this. 1 Peter 2, 23, when he was reviled, that is, when Jesus was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he didn't threaten, but he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He did what? He entrusted himself. This says he continued entrusting himself. And then in 4:19, therefore let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. You know, don't give up on doing good. The world is full of evil. It is. What does Jesus say in Matthew 5? We're cities set on a hill. You know, we're lights to the world. And we need to be the truest reflections we possibly can be. And we've got to be mindful of that. And again, as Jesus was telling the apostles in John 14 and John 16, in that day. And go back again, if you will. We'll go to John 14. I have it here on the PowerPoint. John 14, 19. Yet a little while, and the world will see me no more, but you will see me. And I'll say this also, with this in mind, with the resurrection, when Jesus was raised from the dead, he didn't show himself to everybody in the whole wide world. He didn't go to the chief priests. He didn't go to the scribes. He didn't go to all the people that he had had problems with in the temple. He went to his believers, his disciples. He went to the apostles, of course. At one point, we don't know when, because the Bible, outside of 1 Corinthians 15, doesn't tell us. Paul tells us that at one time he met with 500 brethren, many of whom, when Paul wrote the statement, were still alive. He met with 500 brethren at one time. Yeah, it's an amazing, we don't have any other reference to it anywhere in the New Testament. But Jesus didn't go around the whole wide world to tell everybody he'd been raised. He stayed with his believers, his fellow believers. And that's, I think, part of what he's saying here in 14:19. You'll see me. Because I live, you'll live. Obviously, we have no hope of resurrection if it weren't for Jesus' resurrection. If Jesus is still dead, we absolutely don't have any hope of the resurrection happening to us. That's why I think it's incredulous that the Corinthians did not believe in resurrection. Not all of them, but enough of them that Paul felt very compelled to write to the church about proof for the resurrection. How could anybody not believe it? If Jesus has not been risen, then we don't have any hope. That's what Paul would say in 1 Corinthians 15. Because I live, you also will live. In that day, you'll know that I'm in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. In the day of what? Again, I think when he was raised from the dead and he showed himself to them, if you recall in Luke 24, you remember Cleopas and the unnamed disciple. We don't know anything about the guy. Jesus walked with him, made it to a certain town, and then disappeared from their sight, and then appeared almost immediately, which would be 5 to 8 miles, depends on where that town is, and then obviously where they were hiding. But he just appears. Through the walls, right there. It startles them so much, they think they've seen a ghost, right? And he says, do not fear, it is I. And then he wants something to eat, not because he's hungry, but to show them he's not an apparition. He's an actual thing standing right in front of them. Okay. I don't know how they process that, to be honest with you. How startling that would have been. But that's what he's saying here. In that day, you'll know I'm in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. He'd been raised from the dead. Now all the T's have been crossed. The I's are now dotted. The fulfillment is there. Whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. And I will love him and manifest myself to him. I mean, ultimately, what we're looking for in fulfillment of what he says here is heaven itself. It's not stated this way that I will love him, manifest myself to him, and show him around heaven. You know, like we're going to have the perfect attention of Jesus to ourselves. You know, I don't know how that'll all work, and I'm not even going to worry about it because I don't think it needs to be something to think about. It's just the joy that there will be to be in heaven and the fascination. If you've ever met somebody, you know, famous or you know, somebody that you have a lot of respect for or like a lot, and you see them with your own eyes, be able to look them in the eyes, be able to talk to them, be able to ask a question. It's an amazing feeling. It's an overwhelmingly amazing feeling. Imagine, if you will, I think maybe 10 times more that, if you have that experience, to be with Jesus. That's what Revelation tells us. We will see his face. Remember what Moses asked for? He wanted to see God. He wanted assurance, and I know we don't think about this, but Moses is like, look, if I got to lead these people, I want to know you're with me. I'm not doing this alone. That was pretty much his point. And God at some point, which is interesting, God had already told Moses, I'm not going with you. It's going to be you. Moses immediately says, then I'm not doing this. I'm not leading these people anywhere. If you're not with me, I'm not doing it. And then God says, what do you want? And he says, I would like to see you. That's what he wanted. In Exodus 33, 34, he wants to see God. It's not Isaiah who sees God and says, I can't believe I've just seen God, and I'm a man of unclean lips. Moses is like that kind of character, that kind of person who says, I want to see you. And God, I almost, as you read the text, sounds like he's a little bit disappointed because he can't do that. He says, I can't do that. No man will see me and live. That's a powerful statement. How much you got to think about that, really? And Moses doesn't seem dissuaded at all. He's like, I want to see you. And that's when God says, I will pass by. I'll put you in the cleft of the rock. And as I pass by, I'll put my hand over you. And then you can see my backside. So he got to see the form of God. He didn't see his face. He got to see God's form walk by. That, to me, is stunning enough. But that gave Moses assurance that everything was going to work out. And I guess in some ways we know the rest of the story and all that. But that's what Jesus, I think, is trying to do with his disciples. The world will rejoice. You'll see me no more, but then you will see me. He's trying to tell them, I'm coming back. You're going to be like a woman in anguish, but as soon as the baby's born, the anguish isn't there anymore. And that's what's going to happen. The world will rejoice, but you will have sorrow for a little while. And I think really that was what they thought. What does this mean, a little while? And that's what he kept trying to tell them. It's not a long time at all. I know for us, and this is the thing you could tie it up to in Hebrews chapter 10, where he says a little while, and the point is, God is coming. From our perspective, it seems like a long time. A lifetime where the fulfillment of promises hasn't yet come. But it's not even just a lifetime. It's hundreds of years. It's actually thousands of years since God has said these things. It's a couple thousand for us reading the New Testament. Is it going to happen? And some people say no. I'm one of those, and I think many of you would probably be those who say it's going to happen. Whether it happens in my lifetime or not, I don't know that that matters. It is going to happen. And when it happens, it'll be a fulfillment of everything that God has promised. Why? Because he's God, and we've got to trust him. What other real choices do we have that have the same bearing of hope, have the same power of hope? A song that Andrew has chosen for us to sing as a closing, number 117, Come Home, Father Calls. I know just seeing the title, I think about when I was a kid playing out and your parents call for you to come home. We usually ran as fast as we could. We didn't want to get in trouble, you know. But if you think about it, the idea certainly is when the Father calls, we are going to want to be going home. How wonderful, how beautiful heaven must be. As the first verse says, the light in the window so plainly you see, come home. A feast is now ready, so happy you'll be. Come home, my brother, come home. If there's anyone tonight that has a desire to be baptized, you have every option right now. The only thing holding you back right now is you. And if you've been baptized and there's something in your life that you would like prayers about, you can pray on your own. I mean, you can. That's Acts 8. That's what Peter told Simon. You pray that the thought of your heart be forgiven. Simon's the one that says to Peter, pray for me. But you yourself as a saint, you have access to Jesus to pray to him, or rather pray to the Father through him. And you can do that now. We urge you, if you need to be baptized, please come forward as we stand and sing.